I was asked for the quote where Sister White calls the book by Uriah Smith, the book Daniel and Revelation, God's Helping Hand. And I know it's in my notes, but I'm not finding it. But if you have an Ellen White CD-ROM, just type in God's Helping Hand. And you'll find that that is what she says. She also recommends it along with her books at the same time. If you had that book, you could look at what Uriah Smith recorded on Revelation chapter 8 and 9 and find the pioneer position of the trumpets. And the trumpets were the foundation of Adventism. Some of you are no doubt saying, no, the foundation of Adventism was Daniel 8:14, and I agree with that. But you cannot separate the message of the trumpets from that. If you doubt that that's... If you have a different understanding of the foundation of Adventism, maybe we're not on the same wavelength here, but what I'm saying by the foundation of Adventism is the message that the Millerites were teaching and preaching was this message right here. It's reflected right here. And Sister White clearly says, we have no new message. I think I quote that word for word. Just in case some of you have never heard that and may think maybe I'm putting my own slant on it, this is Review and Herald, January 19th, 1905. We have, as had John, a message to bear of the things which we have seen and heard. God is not giving us a new message. We are to proclaim the message that in 1843 and 1844 brought us out of the churches. That message is here. Now, brothers and sisters, is the health message here? Is country living here? Is the sanctuary message here? I mean, there's inferences, but they were incorrect on the sanctuary. So what I'm saying by foundation, the foundation message of the Millerites is reflected here, and it was the time prophecies in the books of Daniel and Revelation. And certainly the Sabbath, the sanctuary, the second coming of Christ, the spirit of prophecy are foundational, but they were pillars that were put on this foundation, and this is the foundation that Sister White warned would come under attack. It's come under attack directly by some people, but the biggest attack against this message is the fact that here we are at the end of the world, and the greatest majority of Seventh-day Adventists don't even know what our foundation teachings were. And I say that I've queried us Adventists around the world, hundreds and hundreds of us. You know, can you share what the pioneers taught on the trumpets? Can you share what the pioneers taught on Daniel 11 verses 30 to 35? Can you go give a Bible study on Revelation or Daniel 11 verses 30 to 35? Pioneers could. And when you ask that question, the hands never go up. And those are just some illustrations of the fact that we no longer understand what the pioneers understood. And in reality, we're now teaching as a church things that are directly contrary to what the pioneers understood. As an example, the daily. I'm not going to go into the daily here, but just as an example, brothers and sisters, the pioneers thought that the daily in the book of Daniel represented paganism. Today we teach that it represents the work that Christ does in the sanctuary above. Without getting into that argument, please take notice that in the beginning of Adventism, the pioneers taught that the daily represented paganism, and in early writings, page 74, Sister White said the pioneers had the correct understanding of the daily in the book of Daniel. I mean, how many truths does Sister White specifically say the pioneers were right on that one? That's one of them, where she says the pioneers were right on the daily, and they taught that the daily represented paganism, a satanic power, and today we're teaching that the daily represents Christ's work in the sanctuary, a godly power. So without even getting in the argument, It's not a close difference. Is it a satanic power or is it a godly power? So that's where we're at today. Not only do we not know what the pioneers taught, some of the things that we are promoting are directly opposite than the foundation, contrary to the pioneer position. Which quote? Early Writings, page 74. In fact, the teaching that the daily is Christ's work in the sanctuary above, Sister White said, came from the devil. That's her words. That's her words. No, that's in manuscript releases, volume 20, I believe. I have it here, but shouldn't be talking off the top of my head if I'm not willing to dig out the references.
It's in the front of the manuscript, page 17 or something like that.
Yeah, page 17. Okay, I'll look it up. Let me look up another quote first. I'll go there and show that to you as well. I want to show you one quote only because we've... the manuscript release is manuscript releases, volume 20, page 17 through 22. And I don't want to go through that at this point, but that's the manuscript. But here's Early Writings, page 74. She says, I'm cutting into one paragraph. She says, I have seen that the 1843 chart was directed by the hand of the Lord. This chart, directed by the hand of the Lord. And that it should not be altered, and that figures were as he wanted them. And his hand was over and hid a mistake in some of the figures so that none could see it until his hand was removed. Then I saw in relation to the daily that the word sacrifice was supplied by man's wisdom and does not belong to the text, and that the Lord gave the correct view of it to those who gave the judgment hour cry. How simple is that? She says the men that gave the judgment hour cry were correct on the daily in the book of Daniel. So you just go back and you look at who the men were that gave the judgment hour cry, and you find that in their writings they taught that the daily represented paganism. You can get that at the Heritage Room, that chart. Well, when I went there, they wanted me to go to Andrews to get the second chart. Yeah, both now. Okay. So here we are at the end of the world. We don't understand the foundational understandings of the pioneer, and I want you to understand that up in here, you're seeing here illustrated on this chart the trumpets. And why do I say that the trumpets are foundational? Because in the sixth trumpet, the second woe, there was a time prophecy of 391 years and 15 days that was understood by the pioneers as coming to a conclusion on August 11, 1840. It predicted the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And they promoted that view before the Ottoman Empire collapsed. The world did not accept their understanding, but when it came to pass on August 11, 1840, the world understood that the year-day principle that William Miller had been using was correct, and it empowered what he was saying about 1843 at that time, later 1844. So what I'm saying is the trumpets, they were teaching, but it also had a direct connection with the empowerment of the message of Daniel 8:14. There was a connection between the message of the trumpets and the message of Daniel for the hour. Let's consider the trumpets of Revelation, because, brothers and sisters, there is a connection once again here at the end of the world between the trumpets and the message in the book of Daniel. In Revelation chapter 8, there are seven trumpets which begin to sound. And of course, if you were going to look at this thoroughly, you should begin in chapter 1 of Revelation, because this is where it's all set up. And there's no way to get a clear view of the trumpets unless you're going to understand the seven churches and then the seven seals and then the courtroom scene in chapters 4 and 5 and in the 144,000 in chapter 7. None of those issues are disconnected from the trumpets. They're all levels of truth that need to be understood best together. We haven't time for that. What I want to share with you is the pioneer position, first off, on the seven trumpets. In verse 6 of chapter 8 of Revelation, it said, "And the seven angels which had seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound." The pioneers go through the Bible. They identify where a trumpet is used. It's used in the sanctuary service to call a holy convocation. It's used in battle. It's used to call people to warfare. And they went through and they analyzed the different places in the Bible where the trumpet is used. And what they settled on most directly in terms of what it was representing here in the seven trumpets is it was identifying the downfall of kingdoms, like announcing the fall of Jericho would be an example in the Bible that they would use to make this case. And so they identified that the seven trumpets are identifying the historical forces that were used to bring down Rome. And the first historical force, the first trumpet, in verse 7, they identified as Genseric, who was one of the barbarians that came and began to take Western Europe apart. Go ahead.
Alaric.
Oh yeah, Alaric. I'm sorry. I'm reading my notes from underneath that verse. Alaric, from 395 to 410. And then in the second angel, the second trumpet, we have Genseric. Genseric came out of northern Africa. He's the one that the Vandals that made their point of their point of attack came from Cyprus. Pardon me? That's for dates, Uriah Smith puts
395 and 410 for Alaric.
For Alaric, and then
428.
The third trumpet is Attila the Hun. 433 to 453, that's verse 9. And the fourth trumpet is Odoacer. And by 476, Rome, any genuine Roman hierarchy had been removed from the city of Rome, and Western Rome was gone by 476 from these first four trumpets. And the pioneers identify that these four historical forces are what the Lord used providentially to bring to a conclusion Western Rome. The next two trumpets would be what would historical forces that would be used to bring down Eastern Rome, and the next trumpet begins in chapter 9. You'll notice that there's very few verses used to deal with the first four trumpets, but the next two trumpets, which are also the first and second woe, take up the entire chapter 9. And in chapter 9, the first woe, the fifth trumpet, which runs from verse 1 to verse 12, the pioneers identified as Muhammad. Notice that each of these historical forces, the pioneers associate with a historical figure, a man. Alaric, Genseric, Attila the Hun, Odoacer, Muhammad, and then, of course, the next trumpet, the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman. The key that is given to this fallen star here in verse 1 of chapter 9 is a battle that took place, according to the pioneers, the Battle of Nineveh. The Battle of Nineveh. It's worth understanding. Brothers and sisters, how many of you have heard Pastor Kong's presentation on the trumpets? I've never heard his presentation on the trumpets, but I'll tell you a story about that. We're doing a prophecy school in Colombia. You could say a lot about that prophecy school, but we worked all the way through the prophecy school. We did many prophecy schools around the world, and usually a prophecy school is a week long. And it's many hours. When we did it in English one time last year, it was 40 hours in one language. And so when you're doing it in another language, many more hours. And we're in Colombia, and we do this prophecy school. And the whole prophecy school, I know that where I'm going to reach the conclusion, is on the trumpets. Because in the trumpets, you can show a direct connection between the trumpets and the last six verses of Daniel 11. They go together. But in order to establish that, you've got to layer truth after truth after truth. You can't just jump into it and say, here's the conclusion, because if you do, someone's going to say, man, this guy is really out there. So we went through this material all week long in this prophecy school, and the brother that translates for us is very sharp. Tico Restrepo, he knows his Bible, he knows prophecy, he's sharp. But we were busy. We didn't have, usually when we're doing stuff down there, we have time to discuss what we're going to share beforehand, but we didn't have time to do that. On the way to the prophecy school, I lost all my notes, all my preparation, so we had to be developing it right as the prophecy school was going on. So in between the meetings, we were in the room and the computer putting PowerPoint presentations together, so we didn't discuss it. So when we got to the conclusion and we're dealing with the seven trumpets and the three woes and the connection with Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45, Tico, the translator, understood it. His dad, who had been listening, understood. They both got it, and they go, whoa, this is some important stuff. And that was the day when Pastor Kong arrived, because the next week we were going to do some camp meetings, not prophecy school. So we finish it. We're just at the conclusion, and Tico's excited about this message. Pastor Kong gets there, and we're going to eat dinner with him. And we sit down to eat dinner, and he says, Jeff, tell Pastor Kong about the trumpets. I said, wait a minute. You can't over a meal tell this story that takes a week to develop. No, don't tell it. So I start trying to tell Pastor Kong this, and Pastor Kong is going, ooh, yeah, this is pretty far out there. You know, maybe you're getting over the edge this time. And so for the next few days, we began dialoguing about this. And by the time we were done, he says, when we get out of South America, I want you to come to my church in Georgia and share this. And if you can change your arrangements around, we need to go to Korea and share this. So we did that. So I don't know exactly what he's saying, but what he's saying is a conclusion of a great deal of material that you cannot share in just a couple presentations. But brothers and sisters, there is a direct connection between the trumpets and the woes in Daniel 11, 40 to 45. And that connection empowers the message of Daniel 11. And why is that important? Why is that important? I can't show it to you concisely here, but I want to at least point you forward to it. In Revelation chapter 10, the angel that comes down in verse 1 is Christ. He came down on August 11th, 1840, when the first angel's message came into history. He began a process of history that reached its climax at the Great Disappointment. That is going to be repeated at the end of the world. When he came down on August 11th, 1840, the characteristics, what took place, what actually took place biblically, Christ came down with the book of Daniel in his hand. And the message in the book of Daniel was Daniel 8:14. And he empowered that message. And when he came down from heaven on August 11th, 1840, with the book of Daniel in his hand that was going to be empowered, how did he empower it? He empowered it through a prophecy in the trumpets. What empowered the book of Daniel was a prophecy in the trumpets that confirmed the year-day principle. And what I'm suggesting to you is at the end of the world, there's going to be a message in the book of Daniel, Daniel 11, 40 to 45, where there will be an increase of knowledge, but there will come a point in time when Christ is going to empower that message once again. And you know what? He's going to do it from a message in the trumpets, just like he did back in 1840. And the point is this: when you begin to see the connection between the trumpets and the message in Daniel, it means that the angel is coming down. We're not there. The angel is coming down. We're not even to the fifth trumpet yet. So, I want you to understand that we are on a passage that has a direct relationship to the last six verses of Daniel 11. If I could, I don't sell stuff. When I was up here with this book earlier, I wasn't trying to sell that book. Even if it wasn't Sabbath, I don't try to sell stuff. But if I could twist your arm on anything, I would twist your arm to say, get the 40-hour DVD prophecy school, where this whole presentation is developed from beginning to end. It's a little bit of money. I don't really know how much off the top of my head. It's a little bit of money. But brothers and sisters, if what it's suggesting is true, you need to understand it. You need to understand it because it's identifying that the time period of the first angel's message is definitely being repeated as we speak. It's when the angel is coming down. The angel is coming down. And the angel that comes down at the end of the world is not the angel of Revelation 10. The angel that comes down at the end of the world is the angel of Revelation 18. And the angel of Revelation 18 is the angel that we say brings the latter rain message. So, Sister White, I don't have these particular notes prepared for this presentation. We're just going off the cuff here. Sister White says, "We will be surprised in the simple ways that the Lord finishes His work." You remember that quote? Might not be word for word. Brothers and sisters, we just showed you something very simple. A triple application of prophecy. It's very simple to see. Now, we didn't go into it in depth. But the first Elijah, combined with the second Elijah, John the Baptist, illustrates the third Elijah. And as it does so, it brings clarity into the subject of Rome at the end of the world. And the first fall of Babylon, combined with the second fall of Babylon, describes the fall of Babylon at the end of the world. How hard is that? Pretty simple, right? For pagan Rome combined with papal Rome illustrates modern Rome. First abomination of desolation combined with the second abomination of desolation illustrates the third abomination of desolations. There are truths that are established in these triple applications of prophecy that I'm not touching on that are important. They're important because these truths have a direct bearing to the last six verses of Daniel 11. For an example, I know that some of you are not familiar with the last six verses of Daniel 11, or you're slightly familiar. Some of you are more familiar than others, but some of you don't realize there's a controversy going on in self-supporting ministries over this. Why Pippinger is teaching error about the last six verses of Daniel 11, and there's a controversy going on between this teaching and the Biblical Research Department. So there's a controversy going on between the General Conference and what we're teaching, and a controversy between the self-supporting ministry and what we're teaching. And one of the primary arguments is that in verse 41 of Daniel 11, that the glorious land is the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We're teaching that the glorious land in verse 41 is the United States. Now, brothers and sisters, pagan Rome, before it ruled the world supremely, had to conquer three geographical areas. Papal Rome, before it ruled the world supremely, had to conquer three geographical areas. When it comes to modern Rome at the end of the world, it has to conquer the King of the South, the glorious land, and Egypt. To identify the glorious land as the Seventh-day Adventist Church is not identifying a geographical area. It's identifying a spiritual entity. To say the King of the South is the Soviet Union, geographical area. The glorious land, United States, geographical area. Egypt, the countries of the world, geographical area. These triple applications of prophecy, brothers and sisters, they bring the message of Daniel 11 into clarity. So all we're teaching you here today is a triple application of prophecy. We're not applying them the way that you can apply them or you should apply them. So, fifth trumpet. Notice that in the trumpets, God makes a distinction between the first four trumpets and the last three. All seven trumpets are trumpets, but the last three trumpets are also called woes. The first woe is Muhammad. Now, it's interesting. We're going to suggest to you here, as we did last night, and I know we did this last night, but I believe repetition is important. The first woe, the fifth trumpet, is Islam. It's Islam in Arabia. The historical figure associated with the first woe is Muhammad. And the purpose of the trumpets was to bring down Rome. In the first woe, the fifth trumpet, during the history associated with Muhammad, Islam was going to come into history and it was going to come together and it was begin to chastise Rome, Eastern Rome. It wasn't going to defeat it. The first woe, the fifth trumpet, was simply warfare against pagan Rome. But in the sixth trumpet, the second woe, which the historical figure associated with it is Otman, then Eastern Rome comes to its conclusion. And that's why in the prophecy, in the second woe, it says that it would kill it. whereas in the first, well, it would torment it. So, the pioneers, this is the pioneer teaching. If you had the book by Uriah Smith, you'd see that this is what they taught, that the characteristics of Islam in the first woe, the fifth trumpet, during the time period of Muhammad, is that they struck suddenly and violently. That was their mode of warfare against the armies of Rome. In the second woe, the sixth trumpet, the period associated with Ottoman, whatever you want to call him, it was once again Islam, and they struck suddenly and violently in their warfare against the armies of Rome, but they were to kill the armies of Rome, and also they began to use explosives because that's when gunpowder came into history. It's interesting to note that we are teaching that the third woe began on 9/11. Okay? Now, what's interesting about that is that radical Islam today says that since 9/11, we're in the third great jihad. Radical Islam teaches that the second jihad was the time period associated with Ottoman, and the first jihad was the time period of Muhammad. That's Islam's teaching. It agrees with the pioneer teaching. Pioneers did not teach anything about 9/11. But brothers and sisters, this is your course here, in those of you that have been to the prophecy school are not allowed to participate. Sister White says that, gracias. Sister White says that we'll be surprised at the simple methods that the Lord uses. Finish his work. We've been sharing with you a triple application of prophecy. We're saying that the first time a prophecy comes to pass, that that's the first witness, and that the woes have been specifically identified in prophecy as three. One of the characteristics of these triple applications of prophecy is that they have to do with Rome. The pioneers taught that the first four trumpets brought down Western Rome. These two trumpets brought down Eastern Rome. The pioneers taught that the third woe is what brings down modern Rome. So we're not stepping outside of the pioneer teaching on this. But we're saying that the first woe was Islam that attacked the armies of Rome. That's what the pioneers taught. That they struck suddenly and violently. And that the second, there's more to it. We're keeping it simple. The second woe was Islam, according to the pioneers, that attacked the armies of Rome, same thing. They struck suddenly and violently with explosives. So, in a triple application of prophecy class, this is your test question. If this is the characteristics of the first woe, and this is what the pioneers define it as, and this is the characteristics of the second woe, upon the testimony of two, a thing is established, tell me, what's the characteristics of the third woe going to be? It's going to be Islam attacking the armies of Rome. What is the army of Rome at the end of the world? The USA. How are they going to attack it? Suddenly, violently, with an emphasis on explosives. And when you see that happen, brothers and sisters, what does it mean? It means that on 9/11, the third woe arrived in history. And what's it teaching us? That we're at the very end of the world, because the power that is going to bring down modern Rome, the threefold union of the beast, dragon, and the false prophet, is already being raised up providentially. Brothers and sisters, we're at the very end of the world. Now, how hard was that? How hard was that? Now, brothers and sisters, what we're talking about here is a truth that's simple to convey, but it's confirmed in the newspapers every day. It's a message that if someone in the world will take time to follow the logic of it, they'll see that it's really happening. This isn't some metaphysical thought. This is an understanding that is directly connecting with what's going on planet Earth today. So, let me show you something in closing this up, if you will see it. I've been trying to emphasize for us here throughout last night and this morning that when the seven thunders were sealed up in Revelation 10, verse 4, according to Sister White, that's the history. Let me read it to you. We read it last night. After the seven thunders uttered their voices, the injunction comes to John as to Daniel in regard to the little book. Seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered. These relate to future events which will be disclosed in their order. Now, Sister White wrote this in 1900. She says, whatever the seven thunders symbolize, whatever they represent, they're in the future to 1900. And I'd submit to you, they're at the end of the world. But in this same passage, the next paragraph, she says, the special light given to John, which was expressed in the seven thunders, was a delineation of events which would transpire under the first and second angels' messages. So she says the seven thunders not only represent events that take place at the end of the world, they represent the history of the first and second angel's message. And inspiration is clear. The first angel's message came into history in 1840, August 11th, if you want to get real technical. Second angel's message, 1842. And the second angel's message ran into the third message in 1844. So what Sister White is saying is that the seven thunders represent the events that took place from 1840 to 1844. And they're paralleling the events that are taking place on planet Earth today in Adventism. They are. That's why Sister White says Adventism is illustrated by the parable of the ten virgins. And the parable of the ten virgins has been, in this history, fulfilled to the very letter. And it will be fulfilled to the very letter again. Again. There are other places where inspiration teaches that that history will be repeated again. One of those histories we haven't mentioned, I'm sure that most of you are familiar with, there's at least five different places where Sister White says that the two times that Christ cleansed the temple, you remember Christ cleansed the temple two times when he was on earth, that those represent two things that happen at the end of the world. And what are the two things that those symbolize at the end of the world? The second angel's message and the fourth angel's message. Sister White's clear. She talked about five different times. So my point is this. In this history, 1840 to 1844, the second angel's message reaches its conclusion. It reaches its climax right here on October 22nd, 1844. And Sister White says, this second angel's message parallels the first time that Christ cleansed this sanctuary. But the second time that Christ cleansed the temple when he was on earth, it parallels the fourth angel's message. Brothers and sisters, the fourth angel's message arrives in history at the Sunday law. Third angel's message joins the fourth at the Sunday law. You can show that. So what's my point? Sister White is saying that in the history of the two cleansings of the temple, you have the history of the Millerite movement and you have the history of God's people at the end of the world, and that there's a cleansing that took place. And when the second angel's message reached its conclusion on October 22nd, 1844, what happened in Adventism? It went from 50,000 down to 50 overnight. What is that? That's a 1,000-to-1 ratio in the first temple cleansing, in the second angel's message. And at the Sunday law, when the fourth angel's message joins the third, Christ is going to cleanse his temple again. That's part of the history that's repeated. So, the ratio was the same. At the Sunday law, if once again Christ cleanses temple and the ratio of foolish virgins to wise virgins is 1,000-to-1, how many of us in this room are wise virgins? Three, maybe? Are there 3,000 people here? I don't think anyone on that ratio. And brother and sister, that isn't a correct application. I'm simply using that to make us think about how serious this is. This history of the Millerites repeating is serious. 14 million of us, 1,000-to-1 ratio is. It never fails when you go there and you hear that one. So, the fourth trumpet ended. Western Rome was brought to its conclusion in 476. If you understand that the trumpets are parallel information to the churches, to the seals, then you realize that the fourth trumpet, 476 time period, it's the history of the third seal. It's the history of the compromised church. It's the church that precedes the church of apostasy. It's the church of Pergamos that precedes the church of Thyatira. It's the time period, 476, when the fourth trumpet comes to its conclusion, is the time period of the compromise, the falling away that takes place, according to Thessalonians, before the man of sin is revealed. The Pergamos church, the third seal, the fourth trumpet is this compromise time that precedes the papacy taking control of the world. In fact, the fifth trumpet, the next trumpet that is associated with Muhammad, the pioneers point out that the reason that Muhammad was raised up in the fifth trumpet was to be a chastisement to the Roman church, to the apostate church. And if you go back into the history of Muhammad, you will find that that was his prophetic mission, is that idols were coming into the church and he was raised up to protest the idolatry that was coming into the church, the Catholic church. And there's much to be said about that. But what I want you to see is that the fourth trumpet, if you will, comes to a conclusion in the history that precedes the papacy, okay? Follow me on that without all the other stuff that I said. We're going to do something very simple here. Fourth trumpet comes to a conclusion before the papacy takes control of the world. Fifth trumpet, papacy comes into history. Sixth trumpet is the Ottoman Empire concludes on August 11th, 1840. Let me show you something, if you will. And this is a hard one. This is a hard one to get at because the seven thunders were sealed up. We're not familiar with the basics of Adventism any longer in a general sense. I'm not trying to speak down to anybody. I'm just trying to be accurate. Revelation 13:2 says, "And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his seat, and great authority." Brothers and sisters, the dragon is the same dragon that's in chapter 12. And in chapter 12, it says the dragon is Satan. But in the Great Controversy, Sister White says the dragon in chapter 12 of Revelation is Satan. But in a secondary sense, it is pagan Rome. Chapter 12, the dragon is Satan, but it's pagan Rome. Pagan Rome seeking to kill Christ at his birth. Pagan Rome putting him on the cross, persecuting God's people. And here in Revelation 13, this dragon is pagan Rome. But this beast in verse 2 is the papacy. This is the composite beast of the papacy. Adventism understands that in verse 2, this beast is the papacy. And verse 2 says that pagan Rome gave papal Rome three things: power, seat, and authority. If you could raise up the pioneers of Adventism, and I said this last night, but I'll say it again, and say, "Can you tell us what power, seat, and authority is?" They could give you several sermons on each. Several sermons on what the power was, what the seat was, what the authority was. How many know when pagan Rome gave its authority to the papacy? Notice, it's been sealed up. It's been sealed up, brothers and sisters. This is our foundational understanding. It's been sealed up to our minds. There's going to be an unsealing, an increase of knowledge. Pagan Rome took away three things for the papacy. What did it take away? The Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals. And pagan Rome gave three things to the papacy. Its power, Bible prophecy power, military power. Pagan Rome gave its military power to the papacy from the year 496 to 508 in order to remove the three horns. It gave its seat to the papacy. Seat in Bible prophecy is where power rules from in the year 330 when Constantine moved the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. And it gave its authority, its civil authority, to the papacy in the year 533. We should understand these things because all of these histories, brothers and sisters, pagan Rome is the power that placed the papacy on the throne of the earth, and the United States is the power that's going to place the papacy on the throne of the earth at the end. Therefore, pagan Rome is a type of the United States. If you are to understand what the United States is doing in the world today, you need to understand what pagan Rome did back then. That's how important this is, because it's happening. That's how important it is. For instance, in 533, in a religious crisis, this is how the pioneers understand it. This is how they teach it. In a religious crisis, the religious crisis that's going on in the Roman Empire at this time is the church in Constantinople the preeminent church, or is the church in Rome the preeminent church? Okay? So there's a religious crisis going on in this history. The emperor at this time is Justinian. But at this time also, in 533, the Roman Empire is falling apart. The Roman Empire ruled supremely for 360 years, for a time, according to Daniel 11:24. That 360 years began in 31 BC. It concluded in the year 330, when Constantinople became the capital of the empire. From that point on, brothers and sisters, what happened? The trumpets began to blow in the book of Revelation. They ruled supremely, but as soon as the capital is moved, the empire is divided in two, the historical forces that are going to bring the Roman Empire down begin to blow. This is the trumpets. The trumpets come into the book of Daniel right here. It's falling apart. So this is in 330 this starts. By 533, Justinian, the emperor of Eastern Rome and Constantinople, his empire is falling apart. His empire is falling apart. And he has a religious crisis, and he determines that it's politically best for him if he enters into this religious crisis and identifies the Pope of Rome as the head of the churches and the corrector of heretics. And in doing so, he provided the authority for the Pope to turn around and say, "You're a heretic, off with your head." And it's this date that the authority of pagan Rome was turned over to the papacy. It's at this date that pagan Rome moved out of the city of Rome and gave the city of Rome as the seat of operation exclusively to the papacy. But three horns had to be removed. And in order to do that, Daniel chapter 7, pagan Rome disintegrates into 10 nations. Three of these nations need to be removed. They're going to be removed by these seven European kings. The first of those seven European kings to begin the work of removing the three horns and placing the papacy on the throne of the earth was Clovis. And brothers and sisters, if we had time, we could show you that Clovis is paralleled today by a man called Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is paralleled the work of Clovis. This is important stuff. And it's also serious stuff in the sense that if you're going to carry this message to the world, and this is the world, notice what's happened to Ronald Reagan. He's become such a hero and an icon that now we have to go out to the world and say, this man is the man that began the work of placing the Antichrist back on the throne of the earth. You know, and we're years behind, but in any case, well, I'm not proving that to you. I'm just saying that Clovis began the work of placing the papacy on the throne of the earth. By the way, this year 508, this is the year that the pioneers say that the daily was removed. Paganism. 508. From 496 to 508, according to history, according to the pioneers, King Arthur, what if the most famous king back in there, he bows to Rome. Now, here's what happened when they bowed to Rome, according to history, and which the pioneers recorded. King Arthur, England, 508. 496 to 508, the seven European kings come into alignment with the papacy. And in doing so, they turn their militaries over to the direction of the papacy. That's one of the things that takes place. They begin the work of removing the three horns of the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals. And they do one other thing. What was pagan Rome? It was pagan. And one by one, starting with Clovis, these seven European kings, we're not familiar with this in the United States, but still in many countries in the world, countries have a legal religion for their countries. We don't have that here yet, but many countries still do. And in those day and age, they all did. And these were pagan countries. And the legal religion of each of these countries was paganism. But when Clovis bowed to the Pope, not only did he turn his military and his economic power over to the papacy, but he removed the profession of paganism as the legal religion and made the legal religion in his country Catholicism. And each of these seven European kings did. And that's why the pioneers say in 508, paganism had been taken away. It was taken away from the kingdom. Now, what is Catholicism? It's paganism with the profession of Christianity. But nevertheless, it had been legally removed from those seven European nations by the year 508. So, what do I want you to see here? Back to the trumpets. The fourth trumpet comes up to this time period. The fifth trumpet begins in 538 when the papacy is established and empowered. So at the end of the... Now, this is going to be kind of obscure. So take a breath. It's simple, but it's a little bit tricky the first time you hear this. Justinian, in 533, he gave his kingdom away, and shortly thereafter, he was swept away. In 533, he gave his civil authority over to the papacy, and 5 years later, the papacy became the fifth kingdom of Bible prophecy. So all I want you to see here is that you have a king without a shot being fired, giving his kingdom away, and shortly thereafter, his kingdom is swept away. Follow the thought there? Because that happened at the end of the fourth trumpet. Now, it's Revelation that makes the distinction between the trumpets and the woes. They're all trumpets, but the last three trumpets are three woes. The first woe comes to a conclusion according to history and the pioneers, and you can read it in Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith, when the very last emperor of pagan Rome, what was his name? Constantine the last. His brother or his father had died, and he inherited the throne. But at that time, the sultans of Turkey were so powerful that he was afraid to take the throne without permission. And therefore, he gave his kingdom away. That took place on July 27th, 1449. He gave his kingdom away by asking permission to ascend the throne. The Bible teaches that if you're in submission to someone, they are the ones that are ruling over you. He gave his kingdom away on July 27th, 1449. And in 1453, the Ottoman Turks came in and took Constantinople anyway. He gave his kingdom away, and shortly thereafter, his kingdom was gone. That was the conclusion of the fifth trumpet, the first woe, and the fulfillment of the time prophecy in the sixth trumpet, the second woe, is when the last king, although they don't call him a king, Pasha of the Ottoman Empire, gave his kingdom away to the four great European powers. And shortly thereafter, his kingdom was gone. So what am I saying? I'm saying this. In the trumpets, there are many lines of prophetic truth. There are many lines of prophetic truth. And I just want to show you one to try to spark your interest to see the connection between Revelation and Daniel here at the end of the world. In the trumpets, one of the prophetic characteristics of the trumpets is that the first four trumpets conclude with the king giving his kingdom away, and shortly thereafter his kingdom is gone. If you understand what I'm saying, even if you don't know why I'm saying it, do you understand what I'm saying? And at the end of the first woe, the same characteristic is identified with Constantine the Last. And at the end of the 391-year, 15-day time prophecy of the second woe, the last king of Turkey does the same thing. All right? So what I'm saying to you is that there's a connection between these trumpets and the last six verses of Daniel 11. And I'm just going to give you one little tidbit to try to see if this makes sense to you. Daniel 11:40 is describing the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989. Who was the head of the Soviet Union when it came tumbling down?
Gorbachev.
What did Gorbachev do shortly before the Soviet Union came down? He went and visited the Pope and gave his kingdom away. And shortly thereafter, his kingdom was gone. Verse 41 in Daniel 11 is describing the Sunday law in the United States. At which point, Sister White says, the United States will pay homage to Rome. You know what the word homage means? It comes from the feudal system. Homage is when the landlord of the property would come to the person that was taking care of the property, and the person that was the sharecropper, there was a formality that they went through. The fief, or whatever you want to call him, would get virtually stripped naked. He'd get down on his knees, and he'd hold his hands above his head, and then the landlord would come and stand before him and clasp his hands over the sharecropper's hands. This was paying homage. And brothers and sisters, Sister White says the United States, at the Sunday law, is going to pay homage to Rome. It's going to give its kingdom away, and we are told that national apostasy is followed by national ruin. In verse 42 and 43, although we haven't defended it, you have Egypt, the countries of the world. And brothers and sisters, the countries of the world of Egypt are representing the dragon power at the end of the world. They're representing Ahab. They're representing the civil power. They're representing the United Nations. And the United Nations, the dragon power, Ahab and Herod, these themes in Bible prophecy that are identifying the role of the civil power at the end of the world. In Revelation 17, these 10 kings, it says that these 10 kings agree to do what? To give their kingdom unto the beast. And shortly thereafter, we're in Revelation 18, and the whole thing's coming down. So, brothers and sisters, I'm saying that there are prophetic themes in the trumpets that have a direct connection with the last six verses of Daniel 11. And the connection that is the most powerful, and we haven't dealt with all the aspects of it, is that between verse 40 and 41 of Daniel 11, which is where we are today, we're between the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Sunday law in the United States. We're in a time period that Sister White says is the image of the beast test. How many tests do God's people have at the end of the world?
Three tests.
How many people knew that? How many people have ever heard that? So you ask Seventh-day Adventists, what's the test for Seventh-day Adventists at the end of the world? They'll say the Sunday law test. For brothers and sisters, the Millerite time period is fulfilled to the very letter. And we read from early writings, page 259 today, where Sister White says there were three tests in the Millerite time period. And if you didn't pass the first test, you weren't involved with the second test. And if you didn't pass the second test, you weren't involved with the third test. And it was at the third test on October 22nd, 1844, where the door closed. And the door closes for Adventism at the end of the world at the Sunday law. Therefore, there are two tests before the Sunday law for Seventh-day Adventists. At the Sunday law, according to Testimonies, Volume 5, page 214, she says, no one will receive the seal of God that has one spot or stain upon their character. It is left with us to remedy the defects of our character. Then the latter rain will be poured out upon us, as the early rain was poured out upon the disciples on the days of Pentecost. When the decree goes forth, their characters will remain pure and spotless for eternity. If you look closely at page 214 of Testimonies, Volume 5, there's other places, but if you look closely, you realize that at the Sunday law, we either receive the mark of the beast, the seal of God, whichever we receive is Seventh-day Adventists. So we keep that character for eternity. And it's at that point that when we receive the seal of God, then the latter rain is poured out. And in that sense, brothers and sisters, if I reach a point to where my character is set for eternity, my probation's closed. So what I'm saying, in a very short way, but you can prove it a lot of ways, but what I'm saying is that the Sunday law, our probation closes. At the Sunday law, we receive the seal of God. And Sister White says, in Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, Volume 7, page 796, I believe, or we have it, you can look. We can look at it. She says, "The Lord has shown me clearly that the image of the beast will be formed before probation closes. For it is the great test for the people of God, by which their eternal destiny will be decided. This is the test they must have before they are sealed." There's a test that we have before we're sealed by which our eternal destiny is decided. There's a test that is the great test for the people of God that takes place before the Sunday law. In fact, there's even a test before that. So, brothers and sisters, the image of the beast test, because in that passage she's talking about the image of the beast test, there's only one definition of the image of the beast in inspiration. It's the combination of church and state with the church in control of the relationship. And in 1984, Ronald Reagan appointed an ambassador to the Pope of Rome, just like Truman did. But when Truman did, the Protestant churches in the United States protested and Truman withdrew his nomination. But when Ronald Reagan appointed that ambassador in 1984, all the churches said, "Amen." Shortly thereafter, the secret alliance that brought down the Soviet Union in fulfillment of Daniel 11:40 took place. And the image of the beast test was underway. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1989. In 1989, the Christian Coalition was formed. Brothers and sisters, look at the characteristics of the National Reform Movement in Sister White's day. Sister White is very clear. Start in Testimonies, Volume 5, page 711. She deals with the National Reform Movement, the movement that was pushing for a Sunday law, and she outlines the characteristics of that movement, and those characteristics are identical to the Christian Coalition, which began in 1989 at the collapse of the Soviet Union. That's when Pat Robertson founded it. He's outlined five goals, brothers and sisters. First, for people in every voting precinct in the United States. He had accomplished that before the 1994 elections. First goal accomplished. When Sister White spoke of the national reform movement of her day, she says, "This is the third angel's message. This is the present truth message that is designed to arouse the people of God." Read Testimonies, Volume 5, page 7 and 11 and onward. Those are her words, not mine. That was the National Reform Movement, brothers and sisters. That was the Christian Coalition. The second goal for Pat Robertson was to take control of the Congress, which he did in 1994. Since 1994, the Christian Coalition, united with the Catholics in Congress, have had the votes for a Sunday law and to override a presidential veto since 1994, they've only increased in power every election since then. The third goal for Pat Robertson was to put a man in the presidency that was under his thumb. He's been there since the year 2000. The fourth goal for Pat Robertson and the Christian Coalition was to secure the Supreme Court. Brothers and sisters, it's a done deal. There's only one goal left for Pat Robertson. You know what the goal is? He doesn't say it that way. But Sister White says the leaders of this movement do not know where they're going. They don't know what they're doing. But let me read you his own words about the purpose of the Christian Coalition. What happens at the Sunday law in the United States? Well, one of the things that happens is that the Constitution of the United States was overturned. And Pat Robertson said, in 1993, "There is no such thing as separation of church and state in the Constitution. It is a lie of the left, and we're not going to take it anymore." The fifth goal of the Christian Coalition is to remove the separation of church and state from the Constitution. And as Seventh-day Adventists, we know that takes place at the Sunday law. Brothers and sisters, when Sister White's dealing with the national reform movement of her day, She says, when you see this, and you know church and state's coming together, and you know the Sunday law is imminent, and you know that probation's about to close, and if you do not have a character prepared for the seal of God, you are going to receive the mark of the beast. That's Daniel 11, 40 to 45. But there is an issue in prophecy that catapults this movement into high gear. You know what it is? Genesis 16. 11, is it 11? 12 was coming to my mind. Genesis 16, 11. Oh, that's a good one to remember. Brothers and sisters, from what I'm hearing here, bits and pieces, Steve Dickey's been through here. Steve Dickey has clearly identified that Islam has had a role in Bible prophecy down through history. One of the ways that you can show this is the fact that Ishmael was not only the firstborn of Abraham, but how many children did Ishmael throw? 12. Brothers and sisters, 12 is a number associated with God's kingdom. The Bible locks Ishmael in with God's kingdom, and the descendants of Ishmael have always had a role to play in Bible prophecy as a preserver of God's people and as a tool that brings judgment to God's people. And the number 12 associates them with God's kingdom, and you'll notice that in Deuteronomy 32, Genesis 32, Jacob brings his 12 sons together, and he gives them a pronouncement of a prediction of the role that they would play at the end of the world in the latter days. All of Jacob's 12 sons had a prediction about the role that they would play at the end of the world, and Ishmael, connected with God's kingdom, has a prediction of the role that he would play at the end of the world. And it's in Genesis 16, 11 and 12. It says, "And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction, and he will be a wild man. And his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him, and he will dwell in the presence of all his brethren." Brothers and sisters, the role of radical Islam at the end of the world is to bring every man's hand together. Every man's hand comes together at the end of the world in what we call the threefold union of the beast, dragon, and false prophet. And the issue that brings them together is radical Islam, the third woe. It brings modern Babylon together and it brings it down, because the trumpets are what bring them down, although it's God and His providential dealings. Now, brothers and sisters, in 533... civil authority was given to the papacy. Why? Because the kingdom was falling apart and there was a religious crisis going on. What I'm suggesting to you, without defending it, is that the civil government at the end of the world is the 10 kings of Revelation 17, the United Nations. And Revelation 17 says these 10 kings have one kingdom, not 10 kingdoms, one kingdom. And they agree to give their kingdom unto the beast for a short space or for 1 hour. They agree to give their kingdom away. The civil authority gave its kingdom away before. Why? Because there was a religious crisis going on and the world was falling apart. Brothers and sisters, there's a religious crisis in the world today, and it's being brought in the world by radical Islam, and the world's only going to keep falling apart, and we're going to reach a point where the Sunday law is passed in the United States. Then the United States is going to go out and force the world to accept a one world government under the premise that this is how we can deal with radical Islam. But brothers and sisters, Ahab and Herod, they had been deceived by Jezebel and Herodias to her intents. They did not understand that Jezebel wanted to kill Elijah and that Herodias wanted to kill John the Baptist. The United Nations is being deceived. It's going to agree to let the papacy take the moral authority over that one world government for a short period of time before Jesus returns, under the premise that this great moral authority can solve the religious crisis that's being brought by radical Islam. And as soon as the papacy's in place, the deception takes place, because the papacy is not after radical Islam. It's after faithful Seventh-day Adventists. Little time of trouble begins at the Sunday law in the United States. This is taking place in verses 42 and 43 when the world is being forced to come under the umbrella of a one world government. Notice something in verse 40 of Daniel 11. I mean, there's many things to share. I'm trying to stimulate those of you that haven't thought about it before. Brothers and sisters, verse 40 is the collapse of the Soviet Union of Daniel 11. King of the South, modern king of the South, the Soviet Union. The glorious land, the United States of America, verse 41. Egypt, the world, the countries of the world. Notice three symbolic walls. When verse 40 comes down, the symbolic wall that we call the Iron Curtain was removed. We've seen it as the Berlin Wall comes down. That's verse 40. At the Sunday law in the United States, what symbolic wall comes down? The wall of separation of church and state. And although the next one is a little bit unfamiliar, it's common terminology with the globalists. When the papacy conquers Egypt, the countries of the world, when the globalists, the United Nations, speaks about taking control of the world, which they plan on doing, they speak about a symbolic wall that has to be removed in order for that to happen. You know what that symbolic wall is? The wall of national sovereignty has to be removed from all the countries. Brothers and sisters, these are the three walls that parallel the three horns that had to be removed for the papacy to take control of the throne of the earth. They paralleled the east, the south, and the pleasant land that pagan Rome had to overcome to take control of the world. And brothers and sisters, here we are. The first wall came down in 1989, the very year that the modern national reform movement come into existence. And it began its work. And it's moving with lightning speed. It has only one more goal to do. 16 years later, Seventh-day Adventists can't even recognize that Bible prophecy is crying out that the Sunday law is about to take place in the United States, at which point our probation closes. That's why people if we die, it closes now. But at the Sunday law, if you're a Seventh-day Adventist, you're going to be judged not by the light that you have, but the light that you have and the light that you could have had you applied yourself. I've actually had people say, "Brother, I actually believe there are Seventh-day Adventists in the world today that do not understand the issues of Sabbath and Sunday, so I don't see how they would be held accountable at the Sunday law." And I'm saying, well, I believe you. I believe there are Seventh-day Adventists in the world today that do not understand the issues of Sabbath and Sunday. But brothers and sisters, we are held accountable for the light that we could have had. And as a Seventh-day Adventist, there's no excuse to not understand Sabbath and Sunday. When the Sunday law arrives, brothers and sisters, it parallels the time period when the Jews went into perfect darkness and when the Protestants of the Millerite time period began to send their prayers to Satan. And it's describing the time when God sends them strong delusion because they did not love the truth. And what was the truth that they didn't love? What was the truth that Thessalonians is talking about that they didn't love? Yeah, that's part of it. But think about it more specifically. And 2 Thessalonians, let's read it. The man of sin. The man of sin sitting in the temple of God, telling himself that he is God. Brothers and sisters, the truth that's fought against, that if you don't receive that truth, you receive strong delusion, has to do with the King of the North. The King of the North. The man of sin returning to his former position of power. So, I'm 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Well, if you could read my mind and you realized what I intended to share, I actually have handouts on presentations that we were going to do that we never even got close to. I'll use them later. But we went somewhere last night and today that I really wasn't knowing where we were going to go. So are there any questions?